This is Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, and today we are talking about selecting, growing, and savoring the tastiest vegetables of each season. Our guest is Kevin West, and his latest book is called The Cook's Garden. And we're going to talk to him about the book, and he'll share advice on growing and cooking all those great vegetables that you've been harvesting, hopefully. And we'd like to hear from you, of course. Are you looking for a novel recipe for your garden bounty, because Kevin's book is chock full of them? What questions do you have about creating maybe the best soil, or are you wondering what variety of plant to choose? Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We were having a little bit of a problem getting Kevin, but are you there, Kevin?
Hi, Jill. I can hear you. Can you hear me okay?
Yay, I can hear you too. I'm so glad that worked. It's nothing like last-minute changes. Oh, we appreciate your flexibility.
I'm glad it worked. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. You know, I just love this book. And I have to tell you, I don't say that to everybody that we talk to, but I think it's just one of those books where you need it on your shelf. Why did you think that the world needed this book? I know why, but what did you think?
Well, Jill, that's wonderful to hear. Thank you very much for saying that. And I hope that it is, I hope it's going to be a reference for people that they can go back to, that they can dip into. The inspiration for the book came from my publisher, actually, Knopf, my editor. The editor on my first book, Lexi Bloom, my first book was called Saving the Season, and it was about preserving, so canning, jams, pickles. Lexi called me, and this was back during COVID, it goes that far back, to ask if I knew about the Victory Garden cookbook. And I said, yeah, of course, I know about the Victory Garden cookbook. I'm sure some of your listeners remember it. It was a spinoff from the Victory Garden television show on PBS, and it was a very successful book for Knopf, for my publisher. And they thought that maybe it was time to do a new version for a new generation of a evergreen gardening and cooking guide, a book that would talk about how to grow what you like to eat, the introduction and the basics for gardening, and then would talk about cooking what you grow, how to have a more creative and spontaneous cooking kitchen life if you incorporate some homegrown ingredients in your cooking. So that was really the inspiration and the beginning of the project, was to, you know, again, create this complete cycle, a book that covers the whole cycle, grow what you love to eat, and then cook what you grow.
And that makes so much sense. And I guess I've never really thought about it until I read your book, is the reason we're growing vegetables is so we can eat them, right? And we really should then have great recipes, be focusing on growing the tastiest veg, because we all know that it tastes better if we can pick it, or if we can get it, like you said, you know, if you can't grow it, go to the farmer's market or go down the lane to the farmer and take stuff off his stand. So, makes
total
sense.
Totally. And Jill, it's a really important idea, is that this is not about self-sufficiency. This is about or homesteading, right? This could be the introduction to a full, you know, life of growing everything you eat. But this book is really an invitation to incorporate some homegrown ingredients into your everyday cooking. Whatever you're already doing, shopping at the farmer's market, shopping at the farm stand, just adding in on top of that, layering in some more flavors and some more creative options by growing some things at home. And it might open up a big journey. Like, you might want to, you know, have a huge garden that that you really throw yourself into, but you don't have to start there. You can start with a small garden and let the whole thing open up and grow from there.
And to help people out, you have this great chart in the beginning of the book about, okay, here's how much time you have or how much this will require, and then you can kind of go from there. And that's really a good idea, because how many first-time gardeners are like, yes, I'm going to plant all of this, and then they get so overwhelmed.
Well, that's the thing, is that planting the garden, putting a seed in the ground or putting out a tomato start, that's the least of it. That's the easiest
yes,
part, and it's
it
also
is.
Kind of the most fun part, right? So my suggestion, especially for gardeners who are just getting going, novices or aspiring gardeners, my suggestion is really to start small, because an overly ambitious first garden is fatal to a second garden. And the second garden is even more fun than the first, and the third is even more fun than the second. So, you know, it's important to look carefully and honestly at how much time we have, because time is really the most limited resource.
Absolutely.
So plant for the time that you have.
Right, right. That is so perfect. We do forget that. Excuse me. Just like we forget when we're gardeners how big something's going to get when we put it into our gardening bed. So in the beginning of the book, again, you write that your mom had given you some good advice when you were concerned that your garden was doomed. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
I really learned almost everything I know about gardening from my mother. She probably taught me how to plant a tomato tomato, a little, you know, tomato plant, uh-huh. Sorry, tomato plant when I was, I don't know, 5 or 6 years old. And she was always my biggest garden mentor. But this advice that she gave me really was so heartening, and it had a lot of wisdom to it. So I called her one May, and it had been a real cold May here in the Berkshires in western Massachusetts where I live. And we had snow flurries on Mother's Day, and then we had a frost on May 20th. And I went out into my garden, and there was nothing happening. There were these little tiny sprouts that were almost being covered up as the mulch blew around in the wind. And I called my mom to fret and to say, I don't know what's going to happen here. My garden is doomed. And she said, honey, don't worry. A seed wants to grow.
Yep.
A seed wants to grow. He said, if you go out and look in your beds from last year, if you look around your compost pile, you'll see little seedlings, little volunteers that spring up everywhere. And she said, that is nature doing what nature is going to do. And our role as gardeners is to encourage nature, is to work with nature, is to support nature. But we can do it with this confidence that our role is actually a really modest one, because a seed wants to grow.
I love that so much. I think it really needs to be on a t-shirt or something. I was at my compost area. I have a volunteer squash, which I usually get every year, even though the little critters want to eat every single seed. At least one survives. So and I don't do anything. You know, it just grows by itself because that's what it wants to do. You were talking in here about the essentials of growing tasty vegetables. What are the four things that we need to do that?
Oh, gosh. This is a pop quiz, isn't it? Let's
yes,
see if
it
I can
is.
Remember my own advice.
I've got it here if you need it.
You need sun.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the very basics. You need soil. You
yes.
need good, healthy soil. And we can talk about how to build soil and how to maintain soil.
Mm-hmm.
You also need sun. Almost all of our vegetables prefer a full sun. There are some that can get by with maybe half a day of sun, and if you want to, we can talk about those. But you need good, strong sun. You need water, right? Because plants will not survive. Your garden, your vegetables will not survive without water. The old rule of thumb, and I think it's still a good one, is the equivalent to approximately 1 inch of rainfall per week. If you don't get rain, you've got to add some irrigation. We can talk about that if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
And then the final factor is time. And when I say time, I mean it two ways. One is you've got to give your garden some time. You've got to give it your attention. You've got to check in with it. You've got to see what's happened. You've got to pay attention. And in another sense, you also have to be patient, right? You have to give your garden time to grow. Let those seeds do what they're going to do. Let them grow. Let them sprout. Let them flourish. Let them bloom. And then let them produce vegetables for you. And if you're attentive and also patient, and you provide soil, sun, and water, I think that you're going to be really happy with the results.
And you do explain that really well in the book, go into each of those, and we can go into those a little bit later too. But what advice do you have for deciding what to plant in your garden?
As I said at the top of our conversation, my big theme is grow what you love to eat, right? If you grow broccoli and you don't like it, then you're wasting your time.
Right.
But if you love okra, as I do, being a Southerner, then growing it is a joy, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage you to think about your own cooking style, to think about the style or even the cuisine that you love. So I'm a Southerner. I cook in a Southern style sometimes, and then other times I cook in a kind of Italian style, and then other times I cook a lot of Mexican-inspired food. So in my garden, I don't have to choose one or the other. I can have one and, right? So I can have some Southern ingredients like, Seven Top Turnip Greens and okra. I can also grow my basics, my essentials for Italian cooking, tomatoes, basil, garlic, rosemary. And then I also can have the ingredients that really, for me, define the flavors of Mexican or Mexican-inspired cooking, including cilantro, right? And maybe epazote, the bean herb, and so on and so forth. So I encourage you to cook, to grow what you love to eat, what you love to cook, food that is meaningful for you, so that the garden becomes a kind of portrait, a kind of self-portrait almost.
Yeah, I really like that too. And you call it an American garden, and it's kind of special, isn't it? It's different than some other cultures where we do have all these plants.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about the American garden is that, and it has to do with our American soil, right, which is
true,
so rich, and
true.
Our American climate, which is so favorable, but also with our history, right? We have such a sort of complex history here, and our gardens can reflect that. So we grow crops that were important to indigenous agriculturalists in the pre-Columbian era. So, for example, the Three Sisters, right? Corn, mm-hmm. beans, and squash. I couldn't have a summer without corn, beans, and squash. But we also grow tomatoes and potatoes, right, which came up from Mesoamerica and South America. And we also grow all of the wonderful crops that came over from Europe. So this American garden encompasses really the entire global pantry. We have, you know, amazing crops from Southeast Asia. You know, we have amazing greens from East Asia. We can grow all of it here. And so the American garden is expansive, and it's almost limitless. I could qualify that a little bit. I do have a little trouble growing okra here because I don't have enough heat. But within broad parameters, you really can grow what you like to eat.
Right, absolutely. We're talking with Kevin West. He is the author of a number of books on gardening, including Saving the Season, A Cook's Guide to Home Canning, Pickling, and Preserving, and his latest, The Cook's Garden. What questions do you have about growing or preparing your fresh vegetables? Join in by calling 800-642-1234. Our lines are all open, so please give us a call. Or you can send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org. And this is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, keeping the seat warm for Larry today. Stay with us in the next hour. We'll welcome Diana Allsworth back. We're going to talk to her about how to extend your gardening season just in the nick of time. I hear there was a frost warning up north last night. So, So anyway, we are talking with Kevin West right now, and we're talking about getting the best tasty vegetables to grow in your garden and to cook in your kitchen. So you have a list of some of the best plants for new gardeners to try, Kevin. Why don't you tell us about those?
Well, I would say that every gardener, every new gardener, or every experienced gardener should start with some herbs, because herbs give you so much flavor and so much pleasure. And really, honestly, this book is about more flavorful cooking. It's about the pleasure of cooking from a garden. So herbs are really the place to start.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, what I like are vegetables that grow quickly, right? And that give you a lot of variety, and especially vegetables that you can go back to, sometimes called cut and come again vegetables. I kind of prefer repeat harvest. Mm-hmm. To me, that just sounds more appealing. And so some of those kinds of vegetables include tender greens. So those are all of your salad bowl greens, lettuces, arugula, and all of that world of salad bowl greens. Also hearty greens, so your chards, your kale, collards, mustard greens. Those are very independent and very productive vegetables, and you can go out and you can just harvest them again and again. A short row of, let's say, 7 kale plants will give you a full mess of kale every week, and you can just keep going back all season. I'm not sure there's any vegetable that I enjoy growing and picking and cooking more than chard, because it's just boundlessly productive. Tomatoes, and especially the little tomatoes, the cherry tomatoes, they grow like weeds, and they just produce and produce and produce, and they're fun to eat, even if you're standing in the garden and eating them off the vine.
Which some people are known to do.
I've seen it done.
Yes, for sure. So what are some that we, you know, the newer gardeners should probably stay away from because they're a little touchier, a little harder to grow?
There are some vegetables like dried beans that would seem like they're pretty, pretty obvious choice that are really, they're not so productive, right? You need a lot of space for dried beans. I'd say grow instead green beans. There are some vegetables like vegetables that I love, like celery, that take a lot of time, a lot of care, a lot of water, a lot of attention. Maybe let that go at first. Mm-hmm. Other vegetables that may seem pretty hearty and easygoing, like cabbages, like head cabbage, are also perhaps not the very first thing you want to try. So head cabbage takes a long time to grow, right? It takes a lot of space. They get big, and they only have one head to give. So you grow it and you grow it and you grow it for weeks and months, and then you harvest it and you get a meal out of it.
Yeah.
So it's great, but it may not give you as much return on your investment, so to speak, on the care as some of these other crops that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about it. And it's nice that you brought that to our attention, because sometimes we get so excited about putting something in the garden and growing it ourselves, we don't realize what it takes to actually get it into your kitchen and put it on your table. I love the quote you had from Jan Johnson in there. I grow soil, the soil grows the plants. So let's talk about soil. What does a gardener really need to know?
Well, the first thing I would say is that the flavor of the vegetables in the soil, healthy soil is really the mother of all flavor. And why is that? It's because healthy soil means healthy plants, and healthy plants means healthy vegetables, and healthy vegetables means deliciousness as well as healthy food for us and our families and our communities. So my approach to soil used to be, when I was growing up and around my grandparents' farm in East Tennessee, I had a very kind of straightforward idea about soil, which is that it's the ground, and it's what the plants hold on to, it's what they grip with their roots, and then you apply fertilizer or whatever it is that the plants need. Today I see soil very differently. I see it as a kind of living a living ecosystem, really, that the plants are a part of, right? So the more that you can encourage the biodiversity and the ecosystem of the soil, the more that you're encouraging healthy plants. And also, healthy soil means that you can rely much, much, much less on all of the kinds of inputs that I used to think were necessary, such as artificial fertilizer and such.
So true. So where do we start? How do we know that our soil, what we have and what we should be doing to make it healthy?
So the first thing is to assess what you have. And you've probably seen a gardener reach down and grab a handful of soil before and kind of squeeze it.
Sure.
To see, does it hold together? Does it clump together? Or does it just, fall through your fingers? Soil that's very sandy will need some additional organic matter, soil that just falls through your fingers. Soil that's very heavy and that like clumps together, has a lot of clay, it also needs some improvement. Now, in both cases, your best friend is compost. Really, the way that you improve soil is compost. And I make a lot of compost at home using a couple of different compost piles. But I tell you, there is absolutely no shame whatsoever in buying in bags of compost. And especially if you're starting with some pots, right, a container garden, mm-hmm. or a raised bed, fill it with compost, and you're really 8/10 of the way there already, just starting with good compost.
And speaking of compost, I was expecting recipes in this book, of course, but you have a recipe for compost here, and it's separate from the other recipes, not to get them confused, but talk about your recipe for compost. What are the ingredients?
Well, the ingredients are some browns and some greens. And by browns, what I mean is brown and dried ingredients, if you will, such as leaves, right, such as raked up leaves from last fall. Browns have a lot of carbons in them, so they're kind of dry and fluffy and crumbly and crunchy, and they add mass to your compost pile. And then the greens are things like freshly pulled weeds, right? Mm-hmm. Or fresh grass clippings. And these are kind of juicy and full of vitality. They add a lot of nutrition as well as some moisture to the compost pile. And you want to layer more browns than greens. And you'll see different ratios and such. I would say, three times, four times, something like that, as much browns as greens. Put down a layer of, let's call it 4 inches of leaves or other kind of, a crumpled paper even, or old dried out, rustly weeds or old dried out hay. And then you sprinkle an inch of rich greens on top of that, such as grass clippings. And that's your basic formula. There are more particulars from there, but that's your basic formula.
Do you need to turn that?
The quicker you turn it, the faster it will turn into compost. You can set up a compost pile with layering browns and greens and water it well and then just leave it. And it will, over time, over months, eventually turn into compost. If you turn it top to bottom, mixing the layers every couple of weeks or even just once a month, you will find that the compost develops much more quickly. It breaks down more quickly.
Okay. And what about like vegetable scraps from the kitchen? Are those okay to throw in your compost?
Oh, they're some of the best things you can throw in there. I would categorize them as one of the greens. So uh-huh. Any of your scraps, any of your also any of your vegetable residues from the garden. So let's say after you finish picking your green beans, right, and the vines, they're still green, but they're kind of beat up and done. I pull those up and put them into the compost pile as part of the green layer, and you're just recycling right there in the garden everything that grows.
And I'm assuming you don't use things that have disease or that you might have to, the bad ones that you've pulled out because they were sick. You shouldn't put those in, should you?
Yeah, that's correct. That's fair. If you have anything that is that's really causing you problems, mm-hmm. Then it's better to quarantine that. Let's say get it out of the garden.
Okay. We're talking with Kevin West. He is the author of The Cook's Garden. What questions do you have about growing or preparing fresh vegetables? What's your favorite recipe for vegetables right out of your garden? People must be out in their garden today because I haven't heard from anybody. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. So let's see, where was I going to go next? I know. So we're actually fans of Ruth Stout here on Garden Talk. We've talked about her book for ages. I wish it was available still. But you mentioned her in your book. Talk about her method of mulch gardening and how you've adapted that to your garden.
Yeah, that's a wonderful book. I'm sorry it's out of print.
Yes.
And I'm glad that you already know about Ruth Stout. So I started using a lot of mulch in my garden. And when I say that, I mean not wood chips, but leaf mulch.
Mm-hmm.
I live in New England, right, so I have a lot of leaves available. And over the course of a couple of years, I really was very pleased with how the garden was developing as I used mulch and used a lot of mulch, very heavy mulch. And I just thought I'd really come up with something new. And then I happened to come across Ruth Stout's book. and I discovered that I had reinvented the wheel. Because she was, I think, among the first and certainly the funniest and the most enjoyable writer to read who really figured out or sort of helped us understand that mulch is the gardener's best friend. And by mulching heavily the garden, she would put down just 8, 10, 12, 14 inches of leaves every fall. She accomplished all kinds of objectives. She kept the soil covered, right? So she reduced erosion.
Mm-hmm.
She suppressed weed growth, right? The leaf mulch conserves moisture. The leaf mulch also breaks down and produces topsoil. It's almost like you're composting in place, right?
Yeah.
Ruth Stout would have said, well, there's no point in carrying your leaves to a compost pile and then carrying the compost back to the garden. Just put the leaves on the garden and let them compost in place. So she's a wonderful resource and really inspired me as I was going along.
It is kind of interesting because in the last few years we have had a lot of guests on the show that are like, yeah, don't take those leaves and put them, you know, don't bag them and give them to the city to pick up or whatever. Put them on your garden beds, and like it's a brand new idea. And Ruth knew about that a long time ago. So she figured it out. Yeah. We've got Barb in Milwaukee with a question. Go ahead, Barb.
Hi, good morning. I have been trying to grow beets for a few years, and I get lovely greens, but I don't get much roots. And my neighbor recently said, yeah, what's with these beets? I'm not getting any roots. So what's wrong with our soil? Look,
Kevin?
Boy, that's an interesting question. So a couple of things come to mind. One is make sure that you're giving your beets sufficient space, right? So you want to thin the beets as they start to grow in. And often what we do is we seed more heavily at first than necessary, right? Because you always lose a few along the way, and then you step on some of them, and then you might have some pests. So you seed heavily, seed more thickly than is needed. And as the beets grow in, then you start to thin them. And if you're having trouble with the beets not developing roots, I would say make sure that you leave them well thinned, like maybe 4, 5, even 6 inches apart as they grow. And also make sure that you're watering regularly. Root vegetables are pretty sturdy. They're pretty self-sufficient, but they do like to have regular water. And if it's a very dry season, you might think about using some mulch, as we've been talking about, along the row on either side to help conserve moisture. And if in doubt, compost is always a benefit. Compost is also a good mulch. So if in doubt, you can always apply a side dressing of compost at any point during the season, and it will always be helpful to your plants.
Okay, good luck, Barb. I'd love to hear from you next year to see if all those things have helped you. Kevin, when you say enough water, you said like an inch a week. Was that right?
Yeah, the old rule of thumb, and like I said, it's still a good one, mm-hmm. is that vegetables generally like to have the equivalent of 1 inch of rain per week. Okay. And the way I think about it is that if I don't get a soaker rain during the week, and mm-hmm. I mean one of those rains where you just stay inside and work all day, then I work at your desk all day, then I will water the garden probably even twice. So every maybe 4 days, if I have not gotten a good rainfall, I'll water. And the idea is that you always want to water deeply, want to water thoroughly, so that the water penetrates into the soil, right, and gives the plant a reason to kind of reach down into the soil with its roots. If you water just a little tiny sprinkling every day, then what you're doing is you're just wetting the surface, and the plant grows, the plant's roots grow at the surface and mm-hmm. don't go deeply in search of water.
Absolutely. So that's great advice. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Hi. Your guest mentioned okra quite a few times, and I just wanted to share that we grow okra here in Sturgeon Bay in a hoop house in the garden, which is where we grow our warm weather crops, and so we are able to grow them in a not southern climate. And our favorite way of eating the okra is to pickle it with our dill pickle brine and recipe. And when you do that, they're delicious and they're not slimy.
Stella, that's great. So I've got two things. One is about the gardening side and one is about the cooking side. I love your idea of growing in a hoop house, and that really is the smartest way to do it. And my experience with a hoop house, or my similar kind of parallel story, is that here in the Berkshires, I grow some hot chilies, of course, jalapenos and that kind of thing. They do okay. They do okay. They'll get, you know, maybe knee high, and they give me some nice hot red jalapenos. By comparison, a friend of mine who lives down the road grows his chilies in a hoop house, and they grow, chest high. and you will get dozens of chilies off of each one.
Wow.
So it's just the difference in the amount of heat provided by the hoop house that benefits chilies, okra, tomatoes, all of those warm season plants. So I love what you're doing there.
What kind of material does he use over his hoops?
It's just a plastic hoop house.
Okay. All right. That makes sense. Yeah. Just remember to air it out when it gets really hot.
Yeah, for sure.
You don't want to cook
it. And then can I...
Go ahead.
Can I give one tip about cooking okra?
Yes, please.
This is from my dad, who grew up on a farm, and so he's been eating okra since he was knee-high to a duck. And his favorite way, which is now my favorite way, is that you pick the pods rather small, and you steam them whole. You don't cut them. You steam them whole, and then you toss them with lots of melted butter and a good grating of Parmesan cheese and a little black pepper. And you sort of toss them together while they're still hot with the cheese and the Parmesan, with the butter and the Parmesan. And because you don't cut the okra, it doesn't get slimy.
Oh.
Okra only turns slimy when you cut it. So if you cook it whole like that, you get all of the flavor and none of the slime. And so that is a wonderful way to prepare, and very simple as well, just to steam it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, a lot of your recipes are like that. It's pretty darn simple. You don't have to spend too much time in the kitchen to make these recipes. We've got Stephen. Go ahead.
Well, some readers, some of your listeners may say a few of the recipes are so simple, do we really need them in there? For example, fresh corn, just barely heated through with butter and scattered with a few herbs. And I would say, on the one hand, yeah, you're right, it's so simple, you hardly need a recipe. And yet, during corn season, every time people come to the house and I make corn, they say, oh my God, what's the secret? This is so good. Of course, the secret is corn, but that recipe is to kind of encourage you to,
right.
To share the secret.
Well, as it happens, I happen to have that recipe for barely cooked corn right open in front of me because I really want to try it. But it's really simple. But what you add is you add basil leaves and a little bit of grated lime zest. So you are popping those flavors like crazy. And I mean, I can taste it in my mind and it sounds terrific. So, yeah. Yeah. So Stephen Madison has a question. Hopefully we can help him out with. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. Hi. Growing strawberries, blueberries, and raspberries. I've got a small patch of each, but yet can't really get a lot of fruit out of them any year. Just a very, very small quantity. Any tricks to that?
Kevin, do you grow fruit?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't grow much fruit. I do. I've got some fruit trees around and a few berry bushes around. But I can throw you a couple of ideas. And you're going to think that I'm repeating myself because I only have one thing to say, but I do think it might help you here. So blueberries like acid soil, right? So one way that you can help acidify the soil while also enriching the soil, while also conserving moisture, which might also help with your fruit set, is by adding mulch, and especially leaf mulch. And if you can find it, pine needles, because as pine needles break down, they acidify the soil. So I think that your blueberries might well enjoy having a good heavy layer of pine needles around them. Strawberries are kind of complicated, and I don't have a lot of experience with them. You want to give them a good bit of water. You want to give them good, rich soil, so quite a lot of compost. And you want to be mulching them very deliberately with clean straw to help them along. And the issue with raspberries often gets into pruning, and I don't want to kind of go into that because I'm not an expert, and also it's sort of a longer story. So I would
yes.
encourage you maybe just to Google pruning raspberries and see if you can't find some helpful tips there.
And Steve, a lot of times it has to do with the variety that you've selected too. But the Learning Store, which is part of the UW Extension, has all kinds of really good information on growing fruits in general, trees, plants. There's one specifically on blueberries that our friend Vijay has written. So much information. It's free. You can download it. So good luck with that. Okay, we've got an email here. Bob called, actually. He couldn't stay with us, but he would like to add to your list of things that are needed to grow our pollinators, which is true.
So, wow, that's great. I really appreciate that comment. And I will, I think I mentioned earlier that my idea of garden biodiversity, right, of trying to encourage as many different varieties mm-hmm. Of plants and species in the garden. And part of that is thinking about pollinators. I think it's a very good idea to always interplant some flowers in the garden. I love to let a few plants go to seed every season. So if I have, for example, mustard, right, I'll let some of that mustard grow to seed and bloom, because the blooms help to draw in pollinators. So it's a very, very important point, and it's one that I talk about more in the book. So I encourage everyone to think about pollinators.
For sure. Thanks, Bob, for reminding us. Colleen in Cumberland emailed us. She says that sometimes she gets overwhelmed when all of her Amish paste tomatoes are coming in at the same time. So one year she froze some and later partially thawed them, and it was super easy to remove the skins. No blanching required. Do you use that method, Kevin?
Boy, that's a great tip. I don't. Every year I can tomatoes, and I grow Amish paste tomatoes as well as San Marzanos. And you know how it works. Every year on canning day, it's the hottest day of the year.
Of course.
And so you'll always find me in my kitchen, which is not air conditioned. You'll always find me in my kitchen sweating over a big pot of boiling water as I skin the tomatoes.
Well, a little sweat is part of the taste, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Kevin West. He's the author of The Cook's Garden. What questions do you have about growing or preparing your fresh vegetables? Join in by calling 800-642-1234. All the lines are open. Send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm in for Larry today. I'm Jill Najel. Next week, we're going to talk to Neil DeBoll. He's going to be bringing us up to date on what you should be doing in a prairie garden. And then in the last half hour, we'll talk about invasive garden plants. And yes, there is a new one to worry about. Right now, we're talking with Kevin West about his new book, The Cook's Garden. And Kevin, we've been talking all this time about growing. We haven't been talking enough about actually cooking with our produce. And your publisher was very nice enough to share one of the recipes in your book. It's on our website, and it's called Summer Squash in Goat Cheese Custard. And I wanted to try this so badly, but I just didn't have time. It sounds so good. Can you talk us through that recipe? Do you have the book in front of you?
Yeah, I do. I'd love to talk about that recipe. I love summer squash, yellow crookneck squash especially. Mm-hmm. That's such a delicate flavor, but a very specific flavor. You know how you can't compare corn to anything else except corn?
Right.
That's how I feel about summer squash. It tastes like itself, and I wouldn't want it to taste like anything else. So this recipe, it's inspired really by my grandmother's baked macaroni and cheese recipe. So the idea is that you want to cook the squash down in a custard, in a goat cheese custard. And what you do is you start with onions, of course, some fresh onions, and you chop them up and you put them in a great big skillet with some butter and a little drizzle of olive oil, and you start to cook those down. You sort of sweat them, right, until they become translucent. And then you take your yellow crookneck squash, chopped up into rounds, and you throw them in with the onions, and you gently, gently cook them. You don't want to brown them, right? We're not cooking over high heat. We're just gently getting them to relax and sweat a little bit. And then you want to, you'll season them up really nice, and then you tip them into a colander. So you take all of your squash, once they've started to soften, the squash and onion mixture, and you put it in a colander over the sink. And the reason you do that is because you want to let them purge a little bit of water so that your casserole, which is what it is in the end, so that your casserole doesn't become watery, right? So while you let the squash sit in the colander and drain, you can mix up your custard mix, which is, you know, all of the familiar custard ingredients, some eggs, some cream, and we'll put in some goat cheese, of course, and a little bit of cheddar cheese as well for flavor. And you mix that all together, a little grated Parmesan. You pour it over your, you pour it into a great big bowl along with the squash, now the drained squash and onion mixture. And you mix that up and then you tip it into one of those big glass rectangular casserole dishes that you know from family reunions and church suppers, and you smooth that mess out into the into a beautiful big wide layer. You put a handful of buttered breadcrumbs over the top, and then you bake it. And it's as simple as that. And yeah, it is wonderful, let me tell you.
It looks fantastic. And if you want to go get a copy of that recipe, just go to WPR.org/Larry. Look for today's show. And in that, the picture actually is of that dish. And underneath that, there'll be a link to the recipe. So then you can take a look at it. I'm pretty sure that you're going to enjoy this. Let's go back to the phones. We have a question from Charlie in Bloomington, Minnesota. Go ahead, Charlie.
Yes, good morning. I want to follow up questions on the mulching, the heavy mulching for the last, and I heard you say that you have some variations on that original method. But in the fall, I usually put 6 to 10 inches of leaves on the fall, and I also sprinkle it with 10, 10, 10, I think, to help it break it down and keep it somewhat fertile. But also in the spring, I do the same thing when I put more mulch on. But I'm doing no-till, and it's worked for the last 2-3 years. And I'm just wondering if your method is no-till, or is it till the leaves in? And I also noticed my concern in the spring is with heavy mulch, does it keep the soil from warming up fast enough so that the soil stays too cool if I put tomatoes in and issues like that? So just wondered what your thoughts are and what your variations were to that method.
Okay, thanks, Charlie. Kevin?
Yeah, Charlie, those are great questions, and I'm glad you asked them. My garden is generally no-till. I have moved in recent years towards no-till methods because I like the results that I'm seeing. I like the way that my soil structure is improving, and I like the way that the soil is stratifying, right, so that I'm getting a kind of rich layer of topsoil on top, and then this sort of beautiful, very mineral-rich, open subsoil beneath. So the no-till technique is for me beneficial. And the way that you're describing how you handle your leaf mulch is very similar to the way I do it, right? So I put on a thick layer in the fall. I might sprinkle it with fresh grass clippings instead of 10-10-10, just because, you know, I kind of like to use just the yard scraps and the plant residues that I have. But it's the same effect, right? The grass clippings help to kind of boost the compost or the mulch. Then in the spring, you raise a really, really good point, which is that you have this mulch that has kept the soil covered during the winter, right? But that cover will also slow down the soil's warm up in the spring, right? So what I will do is let's say in April, so maybe 6 weeks before last frost here, I will pull the mulch back off of my garden beds to allow that soil to start warming up, especially for the cool season crops I want to plant early. And then once those crops are up, the peas, the greens, the radishes, all of that, once the crops are up, then I'll start to pull the mulch back around them to conserve moisture. And I know when I describe it that way, it sounds like a lot of work, right? You put down the mulch, you pull it back, you put it back. But in actual practice, I find that it's very kind of natural, and it doesn't add as much work as it sounds like when I'm describing it.
Okay. Well, thank you for those questions, Charlie. Appreciate it. Bonnie in Lake Geneva, you're up next. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm an ecology teacher, and one of the projects I'd like to do this year is give each group 2 pots, and they'll plant plants, and one will be fertilized and one will not. Now, I'm thinking, well, this is why I'm calling, maybe of doing herbs, like giving them the choice of chives or basil or cilantro. It has to be something that's going to grow from seeds, number one, and two, kind of grow a little bit fast because teenagers are a little bit impatient.
What do you think, Kevin?
Yeah, I love that project. I would, let's see. So my suggestion is to go with herbs because they're fragrant and they're delicious and there's a fun quality to herbs. The herb that comes to mind for me is going to be cilantro because it comes up fairly quickly and it grows fairly quickly. And it also goes to seed fairly quickly if you want to allow them to see the whole life cycle, right? And in fact, blooming cilantro is really wonderful. It has a delicious quality. The blossoms are edible as well as the seed pods are edible. So parsley is another great example, but the problem with parsley is that it's very, very slow to germinate. I think that if you have impatient young gardeners or impatient novice gardeners, it would be better to start with a seed that germinates more quickly. And again, I think cilantro would be a good choice there.
Okay, good luck with that, Bonnie. That sounds like fun. So let's get back to your book here, Kevin. That's why you're here. You have over 125 recipes in here, and they're all divided into chapters of the type of vegetable they are. Explain a little bit about why you decided to do it that way.
Well, I guess it's just because the way I think about my garden and my kitchen, for that matter, I tend to think in terms of either a specific vegetable that I love, like cucumbers or corn, or I tend to think in terms of a vegetable family. So alliums, let's say, all of the onion family, or legumes, right, all of the beans and pea family. And my experience is that in the garden, the families, tomatoes and their kin, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, the families often have similar growing requirements. And then in the kitchen, I find that there's a kind of inspiration that I take from the ingredient itself. So just from my way of thinking, the way that a cookbook makes the most sense is that you really go to the key ingredient and then you start from there. So again, if you have corn in your garden, then you can go to the corn chapter. If you have a super abundance of cucumbers, you can go to the cucumber chapter. Or if you have a bunch of, let's say, greens, cooking greens, then there's a chapter that looks at the cooking greens more generally.
And there's a lot of, besides the recipes, you take like potatoes, for instance, where you have, I don't know, four or five different ways that you can make them. They're not necessarily recipes, but they're just basic information.
Yeah, for potatoes, for zucchini, for certain vegetables that we eat a lot of, I offer these sections called basics. And they're kind of, they're almost reminders of some of the things you can do. They're simplified recipes. So under zucchini basics, there's sauteed zucchini and zucchini with pasta and baked zucchini and, grilled and boiled zucchini and fried zucchini and stuffed zucchini. And it's just a reminder when you come in from the garden with your arms full of zucchini that you have a lot of options. You don't need to be overwhelmed by it. There are many things that you can do with that ingredient that are simple and delicious.
Yes, definitely simple. And we've got 1 minute before we have to leave, but Pete in Fond du Lac emailed, and he is wondering what is the best way to preserve his potatoes and onions through at least Christmas time. He doesn't have a cellar, so is there something he can do? They're really rotten quickly for him.
You have to cure them both before you put them away. And when you store them, you have to store them separately. Potatoes and onions will corrupt each other in storage. My favorite thing is to put cured potatoes in a bushel basket under leaves, under dried leaves, or under crumpled newspaper. And that helps maintain the perfect humidity.
In as cool a place as possible, I'm assuming?
As cool a place as get them both away from heat and light. So like a dark cool coat closet, for example, rather than on top of the stove, which is likely to be a bright, warm spot.
That's right. Not next to the dryer. That would be bad. Well, Kevin, this has been a treat. Thank you so much for being with us. And thank you for writing this book.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
You bet. Our guest has been Kevin West, and he is the author of a number of cookbooks, but this one's called The Cook's Garden, and I would highly recommend it, and I think it would be a great gift, too. So we will be back after the news. Diana Alfuth is next.